This is edition number 2014 of the Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 24th of April, 2026. Hello, you're listening to the Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 23rd of April 2026. My name is Tony Escrit and my fellow readers are
Julie Reeve,
Frances Doran
and Ruth Harrison.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 5:30 and will set about 8:15.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes the artist who captured the lives of locals, a legacy built beam by beam, my music for you and the stars of the dawn chorus.
But we begin with the main news items, which include local government reorganisation, the sale of Norfolk care homes, energy minister visit and 1,850 new homes announcement. Let's start with the lead stories.
The radical plan, which will see all Norfolk's councils scrapped and replaced with three new ones, has been branded a cut-and-shut job, overseen by a government acting dishonestly. Lord Fuller, the former leader of South Norfolk Council, warned the House of Lords the Labour government's decision to create a Greater Norwich City Council, an East Norfolk Council and a West Norfolk Council might not withstand a legal challenge. He said there were similarities between the government's latest decision-making and more than 15 years ago when Norwich was granted unitary status by the then Labour government. In 2010, that change was quashed by High Court judges who said Communities Secretary John Denham had acted in an unfair and unlawful manner because of a change in approach during the process. Lord Fuller, who was Conservative leader at South Norfolk for 17 years before becoming a life peer, told the Lords the government had repeated that mistake this time around. He said councils were told to propose new councils with populations of at least 500,000. The three new Norfolk authorities are all below that number. Lord Fuller accused the government of acting dishonestly in its dealings, and in a reference to the lead character in the 1980s ITV show Minder, told the Lords it was a cut-and-shut job that would shame Arthur Daly. A cut-and-shut job is the dubious practice of combining two cars which have been involved in an accident to sell them as a new vehicle. Lord Fuller said that the consequences of all that are only just becoming clearer, breaking long-term contracts for refuse collection, orphaning leisure centres and disrupting the local plan. There are unknowable permutations around allocating staff who will need to think which of the 14 functional parts of our county, each of which delivers 136 council activities. They will need to stitch together contractually, financially and legally, and in terms of software and staffing, in just a few months without even being clear about the parishioning in the former county boroughs. It is designed to fail. The three new councils would provide all services across the areas they cover, unlike the current two-tier system, where County Hall provides some services and the district borough and city councils the other ones. But Lord Fuller said officials at the current councils were now left floundering to figure out how to provide services under the new model, with uncertainty over how services will be paid for. He said, "We were told that only proposals that could demonstrate value for money would be entertained. But there has been no published cost analysis. Nobody knows what council tax might be in the new arrangements. Nobody has a clue about the council tax harmonisation or debt apportionment or the pension fund strain costs. The government have acted dishonestly in their dealing on this. They have said one thing and done another. They have abused their position and spoken with forked tongue. But Baroness Taylor of Stevenage, Labour's spokeswoman for local government in the House of Lords, defended the government's approach. She said, "I'm not going to go into all the details of the Norfolk process, but it was extremely rigorous. Locally submitted proposals were considered very carefully against the clear criteria that had been set. We have always said that the 500,000 population limit was a guideline, not a hard line that had to be met. When we looked at the proposals, it was clear that we needed to be flexible on that in some areas. We made our decisions against the criteria." Peers nodded through the English Devolution and Community Empowerment Bill needed to enact the changes with a number of amendments on Wednesday, April the 15th. The amendments will now be voted on by MPs who can accept or reject them, with the proposed changes coming back for Lords to vote on. But the process could yet be challenged in the High Court. Essex County Council is mulling over a move, as is South Norfolk Council. Daniel Elmer, South Norfolk Council leader, which had put forward a bid for two councils, previously confirmed his authority was talking to lawyers about the prospect of challenging the decision in the courts via a judicial review. He said, "We are absolutely still exploring options, but I think the government's timing of this is pretty despicable, in that their decision came right before the elections, which has hindered local authorities' ability to respond. There's a three-month deadline to apply for a judicial review, and a month of that coincides with the elections. It's understood the government's timetable, which will see elections to shadow unitary councils in May next year before they formally replace the current eight councils in 2028, has factored in the possibility of legal challenges."
The sale of dozens of Norfolk care homes will not be abandoned, say council leaders, despite pressure to rethink their controversial decision. Norfolk County Council has agreed an in-principle deal to sell its own company, Norse Care, and 20 care homes to private company Stowe Healthcare Group. Leaders at Conservative-controlled County Hall said the deal would enable fresh investment into those homes and that the March end of Norse Care's contract to run them was the right time to make the change. However, the deal is yet to be concluded and the council has had to agree an extension with Norse Care to keep running them until July. But since the Tory cabinet agreed to the sale, the government announced Norfolk County Council and all other councils in Norfolk will be scrapped and replaced with new ones. At a recent meeting of the council's cabinet, Labour County Councillor Mike Sands called for the sale to be halted. He said, "The recent extension of Norse Care contract to manage Norfolk County Council homes brings it to or beyond the point where the structural change order for the creation of new unitary authorities will have been drafted or laid before Parliament. To try to rush through a sale in those circumstances may result in wasted effort or reinforce the appearance of a fire sale to attempt to cover up mismanagement of the council care estate. Will Cabinet now abandon the sale and engage with emerging new unitary authorities on how the care estate fits in with their plans to deliver residential care in future?" But Andrew Jamieson, the Council's Cabinet Member for Finance, ruled out a rethink. He said, "The purpose of the extension is to complete the adult social care sufficiency procurement exercise and housing with care tender, to ensure the safe transition of services. The extension is intended to support the in-principle sale decision, which was after a detailed sales process during which an interested party could have come forward at that stage. I see no reason to revisit that decision." Norse Care is also continuing to provide care in more than a dozen housing with care schemes until July. A new contractor is being sought to run those. However, the council has already had to bring in a new provider at the independent living scheme at Swallowtail Place in Acle. After a highly critical report of the quality of care by watchdogs, the Care Quality Commission, Norse Care withdrew from providing the service, with Radis Community Care brought in to replace them.
The first phase of a major 1,850 home development in a Norfolk town has been revealed. The North Walsham West development, which would see the town's population increase by 34%, has taken a significant leap forward. Plans have now been submitted to North Norfolk District Council for the ambitious scheme, which includes a full application for the first phase. This includes the first 437 homes, mostly at the southern end of the site, which will range from one-bedroom flats to four-bedroom houses. It also includes a new link road, which will connect Norwich Road with Cromer Road. The road will be subject to a 30 mph limit and no on-street parking, and would offer crossing points for pedestrians and cyclists and new bus stops. This application also seeks outline permission for the majority of the site, including plans for an elderly care accommodation, land for a primary school, and a local centre for commercial and community uses. The developer said in a statement, "The development will uphold high environmental standards while acting as a catalyst for growth, shaping a resilient and vibrant future for North Walsham." However, following the latest public consultation, there were several concerns about the development, with a particular focus on the increased traffic on Aylsham Road. It's one of the only routes available for HGVs and buses in the town, but parts of the road are pavementless, making it dangerous for pedestrians. Bernie Marfleet, who has lived in the town for more than 40 years, said the situation on the road can quickly become chaotic, dangerous and damaging without proper management and control. With the new development, he feared the situation was going to get worse. The council has said the development committee is expected to consider the application this autumn. To view or comment on the plans, search PF/26/0622 on the NNDC planning portal.
Energy Minister Michael Shanks will visit the east of England next month to deliver the keynote address at the region's flagship energy conference. Mr. Shanks will open the two-day Southern North Sea Conference, SNS2026, which brings together more than 1,500 professionals from across the energy sector. Kevin Keeble, chairman of the East of England Energy Group, EEEGR, which puts on the annual conference, said the minister's visit reflects the East's position as a world-leading energy region. He said, "EEEGR has led sustained engagement between government and industry, engaging with senior national figures and bringing some to the region to witness and understand its capabilities firsthand, including hosting GB Energy's supply chain director at last year's conference." The East of England is a world-leading energy region, combining offshore wind, nuclear, and a gas heritage stretching back more than six decades. Around a third of the UK's gas comes ashore at Bacton, with plans progressing to develop a major energy hub focused on carbon capture and hydrogen. With major projects, including the £38 billion Sizewell C development and life extension plans for Sizewell B, alongside significant offshore wind deployment and a strong project pipeline, the region is already delivering energy at scale and is well positioned for future growth. Mr. Shanks will lead the plenary session on the opening day of the conference on Wednesday, 20th of May. The theme for SNS 2026 is the next 25 years. The event at the Norfolk Showground in Norwich also marks the 25th anniversary of EEEGR, which represents hundreds of businesses and provides a single coordinated voice for the region's energy sector. "This is about more than energy," Mr. Keeble added. "It's about jobs, skills, and building a globally competitive supply chain that delivers long-term economic growth. SNS is not just our flagship event, it represents what this region does best, a fully integrated energy system, a coordinated supply chain, and a single confident voice capable of helping to deliver the UK's energy future at pace and scale.
A Norfolk man who lost most of his sight 3 years ago has won a major golf tournament in the USA. Paul Innocent from Sheringham took the top spot at the United States Blind Golf Association's flagship event in Georgia. In 2023, the 43-year-old was diagnosed with Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, an incurable disease that has left him blind in his right eye and with only 30% vision in his left. But Mr. Innocent, who lives in Stiffkey, responded to adversity by pursuing his decades-long golf passion and last summer in Scotland won the B2 category of the ISPS British Blind Open. Now he has scaled fresh heights by emerging victorious at the ISPS Hander US Blind Open at Green Island Country Club in Columbus. After 2 days' competition, alongside guide, caddy and coach Rob Linge, he won by a single stroke. He also finished top of the pile in the B2 category, 7 shots clear. Speaking on his return to North Norfolk, Mr. Innocent said, "What an experience. I don't think it's settled in, it's just a bit surreal at the minute. Sitting with my wife Kelly 18 months ago, she found England and Wales blind golf. I said to her, 'Can you imagine if I get to play in the British Open? And what if we get to go and play in the US Open?' 18 months down the line, I've played in both and won them both. It's incredible. Golf was going to be my teddy bear to cling to and get out and be able to express myself and still do something I love. I never thought it'd take off like this." With Mr. Innocent every step of the way in America was fellow Sheringham golfer Mr. Linge, who himself has lost an arm. Mr. Innocent said, "Rob loved it. He thoroughly enjoyed the experience. I couldn't have done it without him, and I truly mean that. It was a team effort."
An award-winning artist and television actress is set to bring an immersive masterclass to a Norfolk town. Rebecca Grant will be hosting a Frida Kahlo-inspired sip and paint experience in Reefham at No. 21 Gallery. It follows the overwhelming success of her recent Bridgerton-inspired masterclass. The event, taking place on April the 25th and 26th, celebrates the resilience of nature and the vibrant spirit of Kahlo. Local floral experts, Flower Folk, will transform the gallery into a floral sanctuary with a bespoke arrangement to provide live inspiration for participants. Grant, known for her roles in Holby City, Doctors and Stan Lee's Lucky Man, hopes the latest session will be just as popular as her previous one. Grant has also made a name for herself as an advocate for the UK's butterfly emergency, and in May she will present a cheque to Bug Park in Lenwade. Sessions commence at 11 a.m. or 2:30 p.m. each day, with tickets priced at £50 per guest. All guests will receive materials, tuition and refreshments. To book a place on the masterclass, email rebecca@rebeccagrant.co.uk or WhatsApp 07762551448.
The speed limit in a Norfolk village has been slashed by half by council officials. Drivers going through Itteringham near Aylsham will now have to reduce their speed to 30 miles per hour after Norfolk County Council cut the limit on several roads from 60 miles per hour. This includes parts of New Road, Alton Road, the Common, the Street and Waterton Road. The new speed limits came into effect from Monday, April 13th.
A Norfolk woman has shared her experience of helping British nationals caught in the fast-moving crisis across the Middle East. Tracy McLean from Holt has one of the most extensive deployment records in the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office's Rapid Deployment Team. In her current day job, the 48-year-old serves as head of operations for the upcoming Illicit Finance Summit. But when crises strike, she is one of the people the UK sends at a moment's notice to support British nationals overseas. This time, the call came on a quiet Sunday in March when she was sitting on her sofa. Her latest deployment included helping British people across several countries with complex and fast-moving needs, often carried out on little sleep and with constant movement. This included assisting embassy staff in Bahrain, supporting vulnerable British nationals in Qatar and Kuwait, and helping those travelling overland into Saudi Arabia. In rare quiet moments, Mrs. McLean said she found comfort in small things, such as playing with Chester, a dog belonging to the British Embassy Riyadh Defence Section, and sharing meals with her team. However, what she missed most was sleep and seeing her husband and children. Among the items she took with her included a mini flower pot with knitted daffodils, a Christmas present from her son. She said it was in the ops room every day and was in front of the Foreign Secretary when she visited the team. Mrs. McLean's first deployment was in 2005 after the Indian Ocean tsunami. Since then, she has supported response to Hurricane Irma, COVID evacuations, the Ukraine-Romania border, the Afghanistan crisis, and the aftermath of the Beirut port explosion. Since March the 1st, the FCDO has helped to facilitate travel for British nationals from across the region, including engaging commercial airlines, working with regional governments to open up flight slots and chartering planes. More than 150,000 British nationals have returned to the UK from the region since the 1st of March.
Our next few news stories include plans for a housing development, Norfolk tip woes, outstanding care company and classic car show.
Plans for a major housing development in Norfolk have been given the seal of approval despite flooding concerns for the second time. North Norfolk District Council decided to approve a planning bid for 118 new houses and a 60-bed care home off Overstrand Road in Cromer at a meeting on Thursday. This bid was for the reserved matters, which include the layout and design of the homes on the land opposite Royal Cromer Golf Club, after the outline permission was granted in 2024. It comes after the Council's Development Committee had originally approved the proposals at a meeting last month, despite several concerns over flooding and drainage. But Council officers told members of the committee that drainage was not a matter related to the application before them, and warned them of the risks of rejecting the application on those grounds. However, it then emerged that this advice was incorrect, as the drainage matters do form part of the report. In the papers for the latest meeting, it said the solicitor highlighted the error after the meeting, recognised that the advice given to members during the course of the meeting was incorrect. As a result, the application was referred back to the committee for redetermination. In the meeting held on Thursday, critics of the plans called for the council to defer making a decision and seek an independent drainage survey. Among those calling for this included the district council's leader, Tim Adams, who said, "I am here to ask for the deferral of this application to ensure we get a drainage system that doesn't cause problems in the future." He had set up a petition with the same plea, which had been backed by 240 locals. Jessica Groom, senior planner for the developers, argued that North Norfolk County Council, as flood authority, and Anglian Water had no objections to the submitted drainage plans. The council's officers agreed and said it's very dangerous territory for the committee to go against the statutory consultee unless you have very hard evidence that someone has got something wrong. The committee then voted to approve the application with 6 in favour, 3 against and 2 abstentions.
Norfolk's tips have had to temporarily stop accepting fridges and freezers amid woes at the plants which used to recycle them. Officials at Norfolk County Council said they'd been forced to suspend the service, which allows people to take old fridges and freezers to its 19 recycling centres. The centres stopped accepting the items on March the 23rd. A message on County Hall's website says it is unable to accept them but does not give a reason why. But a council spokeswoman said a backlog had built up because of issues at the processing plants where the council's contractors take the items to be recycled. One of the plants where the items were previously taken was at Newport in Wales, but operators Unimetal filed for liquidation last year. And a fire at EMR Darlaston's fridge recycling plant in the West Midlands has further compounded the problem. The council spokeswoman said, "This is a national issue brought about by an authorised treatment plant going into administration in November 2025 and a recent fire at another authorised treatment plant. Work is still ongoing to clear the existing backlog and we are not yet able to resume accepting these items at our recycling centres. This is a national issue and we're waiting for updates from our contractor on whether this is likely to be fully resolved. The issue is causing frustration. One reader who contacted this newspaper because of his irritation at the situation said neighbouring Suffolk and Lincolnshire were still accepting the items. He warned it could lead to some people resorting to fly tipping. But a county council spokeswoman said, "Our advice is to keep hold of fridges and freezers for now and check back for updates on our website. We will confirm as soon as we're able to accept these items again."
A company which provides home care to some of Norfolk's most vulnerable people has been rated as outstanding after an inspection by watchdogs. Home Instead North Norfolk, which goes into people's homes to provide them with care, received the best possible rating after the Care Quality Commission inspected their services. It was the first time the company, run by husband and wife team Tom and Laura McEwen of NetCare North Norfolk, has been inspected. The CQC rated the service, which provides care to people in North Norfolk living with dementia, sensory impairment or physical disability, as outstanding in the safe, care, effective, response and well-led categories. Hazel Roberts, CQC Deputy Director of Adult Social Care in the East of England, said, "We found the staff at Home Instead North Norfolk were providing an exceptionally personalised and high-quality service that empowered people to be as independent as possible for as long as possible. People told us about meaningful relationships they'd built with their care workers, who made them feel accepted and respected and often exceeded their expectations. Staff spoke about them with the same warmth. They knew people very well and tailored care to each person's unique strengths, needs, wishes, routines and goals. For example, one person's care plan included detailed information on caring for their beloved pet, because this was important to their well-being. Through these trusting relationships, staff had supported people to regain mobility, reconnect with their community and do things they enjoyed again, like spending time in their local nature." Inspectors added, "Most people working in care are kind people, but not all get the chance to build relationships like we saw here. Good leadership made this possible. Everyone working at Home Instead North Norfolk should feel responsible for this outstanding rating and proud of the work they do for people. We hope other providers look to this report as an example to promote learning across the centre."
The new owners of a pub have had nothing but positivity since reopening last month. Husband and wife team Adam and Rachel Miller took over the Cross Keys in Dillham after its previous owners, Paul and Karen Grothier, decided to sell up. The pub was reopened on March 14th after getting a makeover, including opening the original entrance and painting the whole building. It was important for the couple to take into account the pub's historical features, which date back to 1730. "Since opening, we've been really busy," Mr. Miller said. "You could barely move in the pub on our launch night. The support from the local community has been outstanding. Over the last month, the couple has held several events with deals for Mother's Day and Easter Sunday. Our promotion on socials has really helped out, and we've even had a few food bloggers come in and try the food," Mr. Miller explained. "In terms of reactions, we've had nothing but positivity. We just hope it continues in the future." The updated menu includes meals such as steak and chips, Thai curry, French onion soup and sea bass, with plans to get a pizza kitchen up and running by May. The couple both still work other jobs, with Mr. Miller running a recruitment company in Norwich. He added, "There's still lots of work to do with the pub. We want to put money back into the building and the community. The venue also has a large garden area with play equipment for children, and the pair hope to host live musicians at future events."
An ice cream van, with a twist, will be serving sweet treats to visitors at a garden this spring. The rare and vintage 1972 BMC Mini pickup van, now serving up traditional Dan's ice cream, is owned by Denise D.D. Dixon and her business partner James Worley. It will be at Stoddy Lodge Gardens near Briston on most Sundays in May, as well as midweek, opening from Wednesday to Friday. The pair found the van on Facebook Marketplace in March 2025 and decided to turn it into a mobile ice cream business. Miss Dixon, who runs her own taxi firm, said, "I've always loved mini ice cream vans and nearly bought one 15 years ago. As the taxi industry felt more and more challenging and I spotted this absolute beauty, I was so delighted when James decided to join me in buying her together." Visitors to the gardens will be able to enjoy 5 flavours of ice cream and 2 sorbets. Kate McNichol, owner of Stoddy Lodge Gardens, added, "We're really looking forward to having this charming couple and their delightful minivan with us for many of our open days this spring."
A new piece composed by musical director Adrian Connell will receive its first performance at Choir Worcester's spring concert in May. The work, titled "When Did the Shadows Fall?", is inspired by Sir John Betjeman's poem Norfolk, but reflects Adrian's own childhood experiences growing up in Daventry. While Betjeman's poem describes childhood spent in the Norfolk countryside and on the River Bure, Mr. Connell said its themes strongly resonated with his own upbringing. He said the poem seemed to echo my own childhood. "I was lucky enough to grow up in Daventry and spent my childhood in the surrounding woods and fields, had the use of a cruiser on the Grand Union Canal, and played the organ in the church where my grandfather had sung." He originally set Betjeman's poem to music for Choir Worcester, but permission fees meant he instead wrote his own text, using the poem's themes as inspiration. In his version, the shadow reflects the impact of modern development on historic towns, which he said now bear little resemblance to their past. The concert will take place at Queen Elizabeth Hall in Worcester on Saturday, May the 9th at 7:30 p.m, followed by a second performance at North Walsham Community Centre on Sunday, May the 10th at 3 p.m. Also included in the programme are Will Todd's jazz-inspired Songs of Peace, George Shearing's Settings of Shakespeare's Sonnets, Ola Jalo's The Rose, and a selection of American songs. The choir will be accompanied by an instrumental quartet. Mr. Connell said, "Our last two concerts were a sellout, and we're looking forward to welcoming our audience back to Worcester and also to North Walsham Community Centre, a new venue for us." Tickets for the concert are priced at £10 in advance, with concessions available for under 16s. A small booking fee applies for online bookings. you can book tickets directly online via the Choir Worcester event tickets from Ticket Source.
A North Norfolk church is getting ready to launch its 700th year celebrations. St Mary's Church in Tunstead near Wroxham is inviting people to its Walking Through Time event to mark the launch of its anniversary. Taking place from May 8th to May 10th, the event will include a flower festival and a display of shoes from various eras. It will be held at the historic Norman Building and launches a year-long celebration that will end in the summer of 2027. St Mary's is described as an impressive building featuring a rood screen, large nave and chancel arch. The church will open its doors from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. each day across the weekend and will be free to attend. The Salvation Army Band will play on May 9th from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m.
A classic car show that sees 100 vehicles displayed has revealed its date for 2026. Reefham will be transformed into a classic car wonderland on Sunday, September 27th. From 11 till 4 on the day, there'll be around 100 classic cars of all makes and ages on display in the marketplace, and people can explore, get up close to them, and talk to the owners for free. Classic cars have been parking up in Reefham Marketplace for 11 years now, and the event always proves popular with families and car enthusiasts alike. The event raises money for a local charity or campaign each year, with this year's donations helping to fund the new playground at Reefham Primary School. The marketplace will be closed to traffic for the day. Those hoping to display their classic car should contact reefhamclassic@outlook.com to book their slot, with high interest likely to mean spaces fill up quickly. You are listening to edition number 2014 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 24th of April 2026. Still to come, there are items about Broad's Boaters, amateur opera group, harmful insects warning, and a new healthcare clinic. And, of course, The Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, this week's obituaries.
Jackie Allen passed away at home on April the 15th, 2026, aged 78, beloved wife of Peter, deceased, and dearly loved mum. The funeral service will take place at Cromer Crematorium on Thursday, April the 30th, 2026, at 11:30 a.m. Family flowers only, please, but donations, if desired, may be left at the service, and they will be equally divided between Big C and Cancer Research UK. All inquiries to Fox's Funeral Services, telephone 01263 512 427.
Colin Forster passed away after a short illness on April the 11th, aged 86. Dear husband of Monica, deceased, and latterly partner to Judy, dad to Sabine and Mark, father-in-law to Andrew and Lotta, granddad to Daniel, Emma, Lars and Thor, great-granddad to Fleur, Beau, Geordie and Jossie. Funeral service at St Margaret's Church, Fellbrigg, on Thursday, April the 30th at 2:30 p.m. and afterwards at the Roman Camp Aylmerton. Family flowers only, please. Donations welcome for Cancer Research UK and RNLI.
A And now some local events. Wednesday, 29th of April, Home Education Workshop, Rampage Through the Iron Age at 10 a.m, free. An Iceni adventure through time with live theatre performance and hands-on history workshops. Lynn Museum, Market Street, King's Lynn. lynn.museum@norfolk.gov.uk. Telephone 01553 775001. Thursday, 30th April. Dereham Cancer Care Bingo at 7 p.m. Cash Bingo, Flyer and Raffle. Over 18s to play bingo only. Bring your own refreshments. Dereham Cancer Care, Cowper Road, Dereham. Legends of Laughter at the Norwich Halls. Paul Sinner, Kate Butch, Terry Alderton, Matt Richardson at 7:30 p.m. £25 to £30. Get ready for a top-tier city centre comedy night as two of Norfolk's leading local comedy promoters, Red Card Comedy and Shaft of Wit, join forces to bring you an unforgettable evening of laughter. The Halls, St Andrews and Blackfriar Halls, Norwich. Comedy at shaftofwit.com. Telephone 0797 675 9160. An evening with Chris Page, Anglia TV weatherman, at 7:30 p.m, £22, or VIP £30, meet and greet from 6:30 p.m, madammarket.co.uk. Sharing his knowledge of meteorology and climate, Madam Market Theatre, Norwich. Cloudbusting, the music of Kate Bush at 7:30 p.m, Pavilion Theatre, Cromer. Dodgy at 7:30 p.m, The Waterfront, 139 to 141 King Street, Norwich. Yes Please, Great British Rock at 7:30 p.m, St Nicholas Chapel, King's Lynn.
On Friday the 1st of May, Wilder Communities at 10 o'clock, £7.86, norfolkwildlifetrust.org.uk. Learn how to decide if a pond is in good ecological condition or if it needs restoration work to enhance its value for wildlife. Brackenash Village Hall, the street Brackenash, near Norwich. Info at norfolkwildlifetrust.org.uk. 01603 625 540. Charity quiz and chip supper evening for Samaritans at 7:30. Doors open 7 p.m. Tables of up to 6 people, £12 per person. Bring your own snacks, drinks. Cash only for quiz, supper and raffle. To book, text or ring 07702-425-536, Great Dunham Village Hall near Swaffham, or williamsh262@gmail.com.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we learn of the artist who captured the lives of locals, a legacy built beam by beam, My Music for You, April 2026, and the Stars of the Dawn Chorus.
The Artist Who Captured the Lives of Locals, an article from the KL magazine, April 2026. During the 1900s, Britain experienced rapid technological advancements. As the nation progressed in radar, radio, cars and cameras, one woman ensured King's Lynn kept pace with the times. In mid-September 1925, King's Lynn was abuzz with anticipation. Posters appeared across town announcing the upcoming Trades, Arts and Electrical Exhibition, with local newspapers hailing it the event of the year. Following a successful debut in 1924, articles detailing the exciting displays the public could expect to admire, promising a showcase of innovation and creativity. While it may not have rivaled the grandeur of international world's fairs, the exhibition aimed to demonstrate the potential that could be achieved with an efficient electrical service in King's Lynn commercial districts. While it might seem mundane today, it's important to keep in mind that only 6% of UK households had electricity in 1919, and it wasn't until the 1920s that the national grid began distributing electricity throughout the country. Artists such as Walter Dexter would showcase their work. The Hall of Fashions was to display coming fashions for ladies' wear. And in the central hall of the Athenaeum, now known as the Old Post Office Building, visitors could marvel at the innovative concept of homemade movies. Ready to entertain and astound the public with the new Cine Kodak camera and Pathé Baby projector was Miss Amy Elizabeth Purdy, a woman who had beaten the odds to succeed as a local photographer. Born in York in 1871, Amy was the daughter of a pharmaceutical chemist and grew up as an only child. Demonstrating intelligence early on, she followed in her father's footsteps and started studying pharmacy at the age of 20. She was a quick learner and went on to train as a teacher of botany, chemistry, ancient and modern languages, music and art. While she could have excelled in any of these fields, Amy developed a passion for photography and decided to pursue it as a career. By 1901, Amy had moved to King's Lynn and wasted no time in establishing herself as a photographic artist. This was no simple task, as over 20 photographers and studios advertised their services in Lynn, many of whom were more prominent and locally recognised. Competition was tough, although Amy held one advantage over her male rivals. Women had been involved in the development of photography since its inception in the mid-1800s. Josef Nicephor Niepce, credited as the inventor of the practice, wrote letters to his sister-in-law seeking advice on his creations. In Britain, Constance Talbot is credited as the first woman to take a photograph, aiding her husband, Henry Fox Talbot, and his peers as they'd pioneered new photographic methods. Photography soon gained popularity among aristocratic women, particularly after Queen Victoria expressed her interest, and articles on how they could join the profession soon began to appear. In 1897, the Ladies' Home Journal stated, "Women might find this line of work pleasant and lucrative, where employment in the more restricted fields of typewriting, clerking, bookkeeping, etc. would prove wearing and uncongenial to them." By 1900, women constituted almost 20% of professional photographers, a noteworthy amount considering that working outside the home was frowned upon for women at that time. Many photography studios sought out lady operators to photograph people due to the likelihood of physical contact between the photographer and their subjects. It was thought more women and families would visit studios if a female employee was taking their photo. This was a significant advantage for Amy Purdy, and by 1907 she had earned enough to set up her own photography studio at 84 Lynn High Street, where she continued to practice for over 25 years. Her reputation soared, and according to one of her advertisements, she excelled at every branch of outdoor photography, studio portraiture, and at-home portraiture. Before the press employed their own in-house photographers, Amy's name frequently appeared under early photographs taken for local newspapers. She became so well known that the yard behind her photography studio was known as Purdy's Court for many years. As technology progressed and Amy's renown grew, she took her place in the Grand Athenaeum building for the 1925 Trades, Art and Electrical Exhibition. Cameras were not cheap in the early 1900s, so it's a testament to her success that Amy could afford to bring the newly released Cine Kodak camera and Pathé baby projector to the exhibition, costing around £1,172 and £987 respectively in today's money. By all accounts, the exhibition was a success, and King's Lynn was on its way to entering the modern age. Amy retired in 1929, and her apprentice, Percival Goodchild, took charge of the studio. Several of her photographs and personal effects are preserved today at Lynn Museum, the remaining traces of a woman determined to make a name for herself in restrictive times. Amy Purdy played a key role in establishing a respected photographic business during a time when professional photography was still a developing field.
A legacy built beam by beam, King's Lynn Magazine, April 2026. As one of the nation's most remarkable building projects heads to the big screen, we uncover the Norfolk-bound odyssey shaped by two women and a home that refused to be lost. There are stories in Norfolk that feel stitched into the landscape, and then there are stories so extraordinary they seem almost impossible. The tale of May Savage belongs firmly in the latter. More than half a century ago, when road developments threatened to erase her 15th century Hertfordshire home, the indignant 58-year-old made a decision that would astonish councillors, planners and neighbours and define the rest of her life. Instead of surrendering the house to demolition, she dismantled it piece by piece and moved it 100 miles from the market town of Ware to Wells next the sea. It was an act of defiance, devotion and sheer endurance that still inspires today. Now, with her remarkable mission set to reach cinema screens, the house she saved and the woman who later completed her work stand as a testament to a determination that refused to be flattened. Born in Streatham in 1911, May Savage grew up in circumstances that demanded resilience. She lost both parents young and her fiancé in her teens, experiences that Christine Adams, her niece through marriage, believes shaped her self-reliance and resolve. She trained as a draftswoman at de Havilland, becoming the only woman in the team working on the Mosquito aircraft during the war, and later converted an old Thames River barge into a floating home. After battling persistent leaks, May set her sights on another restoration project in 1947, when she discovered a semi-derelict property in Ware. Designed as a traditional hall house, with private living quarters attached to an open hall, it immediately drew her in with its character. As she stripped back centuries of improvements, she uncovered grand Tudor fireplaces and beams marked by medieval carpenters, clues that the building was far older than she'd first imagined. Her affection for the house deepened with every discovery. So when the council announced it would be demolished to make way for a relief road, May dug in her heels and refused to accept its fate. Carefully numbering every beam, window and tile, she embarked on a monumental mission to relocate the property to one of her favourite coastal holiday settings. She resolved to save the house at all cost, Christine recalls with a smile. She even wrote to the RAF and the US Air Force to ask whether they had a helicopter they could lift the frame to a little plot of land right next to the village green she'd bought in Wells next to sea. When they politely declined, she became even more determined. I remember her saying, "It's only a kit of parts. I'm an engineer. I can do this." It took her a whole year to dismantle the house, and she wouldn't allow me or my husband to help. The demolition was painstakingly methodical. May set an alarm clock each morning to meet her daily targets and continued living in the house until the removal of the outside walls forced her into a workshop in the garden. She supervised the loading of a Bedford lorry, which made the 200-mile round trip to Norfolk 11 times to transport the frame, the fittings, and her vast collection of belongings. By the time the main structure was raised in Wells, May was living in a caravan on the site, pushing wheelbarrows through mud and climbing scaffolding well into her 70s. She laid bricks with the precision of a master mason, intent on getting every detail right. For 23 years she pressed on, through storms, failing health and long solitary nights, accompanied only by her loyal dog Sasha. When May passed away in 1993, just short of her 82nd birthday, the house was still unfinished. There were no upstairs walls, polythene flapped in the windows. The garden has grown as high as the first floor. Inside, rooms were stacked to the ceiling with papers, diaries, magazines, cases and boxes. It was a fragile shell filled with a lifetime's accumulated junk. The deeper they delved into the crooked, clutter-filled house, the larger the project became, and it affected them in different ways. Christine felt a growing responsibility to honour May's vision, choosing to retire early from teaching and move up to Wells to focus on the restoration. For Tony, the work became an increasingly irksome burden, one that eventually drew him into a separate life elsewhere with another partner. Rather than lose momentum, Christine only grew more determined. The house became both a refuge and a challenge as she navigated the end of her 40-year marriage. She sorted, catalogued and sold May's hoarded treasures to fund the restoration, tackling the garden, brickwork and unfinished rooms. She plastered, cleared, rebuilt and repaired, often working late into the night. As she sifted through more than 440 diaries and countless letters, she gained a deeper insight into May's passion and personality and later shared her story in a book when approached by a London publisher. There came a moment when Christine realised the project had become hers as much as May's, yet she always felt her aunt's presence, sometimes guiding, sometimes gently disapproving. She imagines her tutting at the leadwork, questioning every modern compromise, but she also believes May would be proud. Today, Ware Hall House stands complete, warm, lived in and deeply loved. A home shaped by two women across two generations, each driven by determination that refused to let it die.
My Music for You, April 2026. The spring is sprung, the grass is riz, I wonder where the birdies is. The bird is on the wing. Don't be so absurd, my friend, the wing is on the bird. This popular anonymous nursery rhyme from days gone by came to my mind as I thought about spring. That in turn gave me the idea that this month my musical theme might be centred on our feathered friends. Needless to say, the choices are almost endless. Composers of all genres have had a long-standing relationship with birds of all shapes and sizes, and I imagine that will continue as long as human beings make music. We might say that birds are the original composers and also inspire poets. As I researched birds in music, I came across blackbirds, robins, nightingales, swans, magpies, cuckoos, linnets, larks and starlings, among many others. However, I'm limited to four, so here goes. First up, and appropriately, an overture, La Garza Ladra by Giacomo Rossini, 1792 to 1868, better known to us as The Thieving Magpie. It introduces a two-act opera which was premiered at La Scala, Milan, in May 1817. It is probably the only part of the opera to stand the test of time, although Stanley Kubrick used it in the 1971 film A Clockwork Orange. The story relates to the theft of a piece of silver by a magpie, a theft wrongly attributed to the heroine and for which the penalty is death. Cutting to the chase, it all ends happily, of course. From the world of Italian opera to an 1886 orchestral suite by French composer Camille Saint-Saëns, 1835 to 1921, who overlapped with Rossini's later years. Saint-Saëns was a composer, organist, conductor and pianist, and like Rossini, part of the Romantic music period. The suite, The Carnival of the Animals, is among his best-loved compositions, and from it comes The Swan. It is the penultimate movement of 14 and was originally scored for two pianos and cello. The melody, played by the cello, is slow-moving, evoking the swan gliding over the water. Meantime, the pianos play a rippling accompaniment, characterising the movement of the water itself. The movement is the suite's best known and is often played as a standalone piece. It was the only movement published in the composer's lifetime. My third choice this month is by English composer Sir Charles Villiers Stamford, 1852 to 1924. He was an Anglo-Irish composer, music teacher and conductor who numbered among his pupils Gustav Holst and Ralph Vaughan Williams. Whilst his output encompassed symphonic, orchestral and operatic works, he is best remembered for his part songs and choral works, especially those for church performance. His part song, The Bluebird, is a secular piece written in 1910 and depicts the bird in flight over a lake. It is the third of eight songs and sets words by Mary Elizabeth Coleridge, the great-grandniece of Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Finally, a break from the classical repertoire as we spring forward to 1939 and the timeless song A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square, written shortly before the outbreak of World War II. It was an Anglo-American realisation by American Manning Sherwin for the music and Eric Mashwitz for the lyrics. It was first performed in London in 1940 in a review called New Faces. The song has been covered numerous times by such as Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra, but in the review it was first performed by actress Judy Campbell, who appeared in many Noel Coward plays, including Present Laughter, Blithe Spirit and This Happy Breed. During the war she also appeared with Coward in concerts for the troops. The notion that a nightingale can be heard in central London is romantic, fanciful, and completely far-fetched. The opening lyrics assert, "When two lovers meet in Mayfair, so the legends tell, songbirds sing, winter turns to spring." Our winter has turned to spring, so let's, for a brief moment, be believers and thankful to the lovers, but especially to the nightingale. Enjoy the springtime of the year until we meet next month.
Stars of the Dawn Chorus from the RSPB magazine, Spring 2026. As the morning light begins to emerge and the air is still, birds take to the stage and demonstrate their health and skills to a potential mate. The black cap. Nicknamed the Northern Nightingale, the black cap has a complex song. Hidden away in thick bushes, such as blackthorn or hawthorn, it's often heard before seen. Its cheerful, melodic song has rich notes and often ends with a flourish. Other birds' songs are sometimes incorporated. Song thrush, one of the first to begin singing, and often the most confident, the song thrush has a truly atmospheric repertoire. Found across the UK and in different habitats from woodlands, parks, gardens and farmland, it will usually perch high up in a tree and will repeat certain phrases two or four times with brief pauses. Chiff-chaff, a truly onomatopoeic call. The chiff-chaff is not shy to shout its name despite its small size. repeating chiff-chaff, 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 with an occasional extra note thrown in, its calls are a true indication of spring. It's very well hidden thanks to its olive-brown plumage, so can be heard more than seen. The blackbird is one of our most familiar singers. Found in a variety of habitats, listen out for short phrases with an almost scratchy end. It has a hugely varied repertoire and can even mimic other birds within the verses of their rich and mellow songs. It perches at the top of trees to ensure its song carries. The wren, small but mighty, the wren certainly makes itself known. A song bursting from thick vegetation, the wren has an incredibly loud song compared to its size. It's fast-paced too. It packs an impressive 100 notes in just 5 seconds, with a series of high-pitched notes and trills, and always ends with an erratic rattle. And finally, the wood pigeon. Our most common species of pigeon and dove, the wood pigeon's song is an iconic UK sound, especially during summer. With 5 notes, mellow coos, and a slightly raspy tone, a good mnemonic to use is "My toe hurts, Betty." Often perched high in trees, look out for it in parks, woodland, and in the garden.
Those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include Broad's Boaters, Amateur Opera Group, Harmful Insects Warning, and a new healthcare clinic.
A special addition has been made to the lineup of a heritage rail weekend in North Norfolk. The Rails and Ales weekend will run from June the 12th to 14th, with services running along the Poppy Line between Holt and Sheringham stations. Now it has been revealed that a special locomotive will haul trains during the festivities, organised by the North Norfolk Railway. We're excited to announce Class 50-50050, that's D400, Fearless, is scheduled to join us for this year's Rails and Ales event in June. Since her withdrawal from BR service in 1994, Fearless has had a number of private owners and is now owned by Locomotive Services Limited, where she predominantly operates commercial rail tours. We're particularly excited, as 50050 has not made many visits to Heritage Lines in recent years, and also thank LSL for their continued support to the railway and this event. Only 18 of the Class 50s still exist on the railways today, with the majority now scrapped. Visitors are recommended to book in advance, and tickets are available now.
An amateur opera group is set to perform a double bill following months of rehearsals. North Norfolk Chamber Opera will be performing Henry Purcell's Dido and Aeneas and George Frederick Handel's Acis and Galatea on May the 21st, 22nd and 23rd. The performances will take place at 7 p.m. at St Margaret's Church in Clye, near Holt, with a preview highlights concert on May the 14th. Catherine Jones, NNCO's chairwoman, said, "I'm so looking forward to performing our double bill. We have an excellent cast of principals and chorus who spent 8 months rehearsing with our stage director Paul Hands and musical director Mark Jones. We enjoy performing in the round because it gives the audience a truly immersive experience. The group is currently rehearsing at the Holt Youth Project. The performances will be fully staged and costumed, set in the round with a chamber orchestra inside the 14th century church." Miss Jones said, Both our operas feature love and promise that are destroyed by evil and death. There are no happy endings in this double bill, but the music takes the listener on a helter-skelter journey of excitement and sorrow. More information at northnorfolkchamberopera.org.uk.
North Norfolk has been ranked among the best places in the country for a walking holiday. The Times included the north of the county in a roundup of the 13 best UK holiday destinations for those who like sightseeing on foot. With plenty of walking routes across the North Norfolk coast, the article praised Snettisham for its range of species to spot along the way. Lucky walkers might see one of Britain's great bird spectacles, the Snettisham Spectaculars, when tens of thousands of waders whirl above RSPB Snettisham as the tide fills on the North Norfolk coastal walking route, it said. This particular part of the coast is also home to salt marshes to explore and cosy pubs to pop in for a pit stop. Blakeney Point, which is home to the largest colony of Atlantic grey seals, was another factor in the area receiving a high ranking. Dog walkers can also enjoy miles of golden sand at Holcombe Beach before exploring its neighbouring beach, Wells Next the Sea, which is famous for its colourful beach huts.
Roads in Norfolk have been named among the best in the UK for perfect driving weather. They were ranked out of 100 on road surface conditions, visibility and clear days, wind speed, ground temperature and humidity, comfort, by meteorologist Jim Dale and Auto Trader. The coastal roads in North Norfolk were praised for their visibility and low humidity, securing a score of 58.5. North Norfolk's roads were only beaten by the New Forest, the South Downs A272, and the Cotswolds. Roads in the New Forest took the top spot with a score of 60.7, thanks to their reliable weather and scenery featuring ancient woodland and the famous ponies. Rated as one of the country's most reliable road trip options, the area was noted for its low rainfall and clear skies for much of the year. The A272 road, traversing the South Downs and the Kent, Sussex and Hampshire Weald, came in second with a score of 60.4, benefiting from a generally sheltered climate, leading to comfortable temperatures and low humidity. Cotswold roads followed in third place with a score of 59.5 due to low wind speeds and modest rainfall.
Broad's boaters, trying to avoid paying tolls, are placing pressure on the resources of its managing authority, its chief executive has warned. John Packman of the Broads Authority, BA, has revealed court proceedings have been issued against 100 people who have dodged their fees this year. There has been a significant rise in the number of cases, prompting a warning from the outgoing chief executive. This whole process takes up a lot of time, energy and resources, said Mr. Packman, who is retiring in May. We have issued court proceedings to over 100 people, 50 settled before going to court. Although some of the people on this have limited resources, and we take that into account, there are people that fully can afford to pay the toll. It comes amid a further 6 prosecutions secured by the BA for boaters using the waterways without paying. Costs from the action taken totaled nearly £7,500, according to figures provided by the authority. Earlier this year, it was revealed £41,000 in fines were dished out for 50 offences involving unregistered boats and unpaid tolls. According to the chief executive's report, before the BA's Navigation Committee on Thursday, one boater was fined £2,200 for driving without care and caution and travelling at night without navigation lights. A spokesman for the Broads Authority said late payment of tolls causes extra work and costs for the authority, requiring robust action to chase those that refuse to pay. Unfortunately, this year, there have been significant rise in cases submitted for prosecution. The Broads Authority urges anyone having difficulty paying to contact the tolls team at the earliest opportunity. Prosecution is the last resort if all other avenues have failed. Recent cases have illustrated that it is far more costly for boat owners if they are prosecuted.
A popular Norfolk gastropub and spa hopes to build staff accommodation to improve security and assist with staff recruitment. The Pigs at Edgefield near Holt has applied to build 4 one-bedroom units for workers. A planning statement says the business requires overnight supervision to secure the safety of its guests. It adds there is also a major issue with recruiting chefs in Norfolk, and the pub wants to offer live-in opportunities for chefs from the UK and abroad. 2 of the 4 units will be used on rotation for overnight security, with the other 2 used for chefs from further away locations to stay overnight for periods of 4 to 5 nights. They will be used by different members of staff on rotation rather than for permanent residents. The statement says since buying the business 20 years ago, the owner, Ian Wilson, invested £6 million in developing the site, with extra bedrooms for guests and a spa garden. It says the pub currently employs 60 people, with most living within a 15-mile radius.
Insects that can be harmful to humans and pets have been spotted at a popular walking spot. An army of brown-tailed moth caterpillars was seen at the foot of Beeston Bump in Sheringham on Monday. People and animals should avoid coming into contact with them because they have spiked and barbed hairs that contain a toxin. If the hairs break off, they can cause symptoms such as skin rashes, headaches and breathing difficulties. The caterpillars are brown and have red and white markings, and they are known for living in tents which they build from silk in trees and shrubs. They usually grow into adults by mid-June and go into their chrysalis state by late June. A spokesman for North Norfolk District Council said, "If direct contact is made, the public are advised to wash their hands in soapy water and clean their eyes with eye wash, and to seek medical advice if the symptoms are severe or persistent."
A new healthcare clinic is gearing up to open at a Norfolk business park. North Norfolk Ear and Skin Care is getting ready to open its doors at Aylsham Business Park to offer ear and skin services which are no longer routinely available on the NHS. The clinic, which was founded by Stephanie Attu, will provide services such as earwax removal, cryotherapy, and the removal of minor skin spots like warts and skin tags. Alongside treatments, she will also offer practical advice to help people manage ear and skin health in a realistic and sustainable way. With the NHS no longer offering many of these routine treatments, Ms. Attu hopes the clinic will fill the gap in the healthcare services for those living in the surrounding area. She said, "I set up this clinic because I wanted to make essential services accessible again locally. People shouldn't have to travel miles or face scary clinical environments to take care of their health. My goal is simple, to provide professional, safe and approachable care while helping people feel comfortable in their skin." Ms. Attu is the only practitioner in the area performing endoscopic earwax removal, a method otherwise only available in larger centres and hospitals. To celebrate, she is hosting a grand opening on April the 18th, where locals can meet her and learn more about the services. From 11 a.m. to 1 p.m, there'll be nibbles and goodie bags, and between 1 p.m. and 5 p.m, visitors can book free ear health checks and free mini skin consultations for the day through the clinic website. The clinic was first established in 2023, but now has a dedicated treatment space at Unit 5 in Aylsham Business Park. It comes after Sam Cordner, the owner of the park, revealed plans to triple the size of the site earlier this year. His vision includes building more than 20 new commercial properties in a project which may take up to 3 years to complete.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was David Mitchell. Editing and producing this issue was Manny Gomez. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's cheerio.